So I want to start by welcoming everybody to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon, where we have one case set for oral argument. I understand that counsel have checked in and that we are pretty much ready to go. Before we start, though, I'll introduce the panel that we've got here today. To my left is Justice Dabney Basil. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So with that, I'd ask the clerk to call the case. Thank you. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Sophia Lakin on behalf of Ms. Crystal Mason. Under the Court of Criminal Appeals construction of the illegal voting statute and the recent amendment to the statute, Ms. Mason's conviction for illegal voting must be overturned. The Court of Criminal Appeals has construed the illegal voting statute to require that the state prove that Ms. Mason actually realized that she was ineligible to vote at the time she submitted her provisional ballot in 2016. There is insufficient evidence in the record to rationally support that conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt for at least three reasons. First, the state's theory of knowledge here depends on Ms. Mason having read the left-hand side of the provisional ballot affidavit, which, as you can see from the handout, is the only part of the affidavit containing any reference at all to post-felony conviction statuses. From there, the state theory goes, Ms. Mason immediately realized that she was ineligible to vote and then filled in all of her correct information and submitted her provisional ballot anyway, despite the fact that she had nothing to gain and everything to lose by doing so. But the evidence in the record, even viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict, is explicitly uncertain as to whether she read the left-hand side of the affidavit. The evidence shows, at best, that Ms. Mason filled out and signed the right-hand side of the affidavit and looked over for some number of seconds at the left-hand side. Making the leap from this explicitly uncertain testimony to a conclusion that Ms. Mason, in fact, read the left-hand side of the affidavit can't be rationally supported beyond a reasonable doubt. And looking at the provisional ballot affidavit shows us why. There's nothing for the voter to fill out or sign or otherwise draw the voter's attention to actually read the left-hand side of the affidavit.
What are we to make of the language immediately above the admonishment, the affirmation that says, to be completed by voter?
Your Honor,
that's immediately above the language that's in question here.
You're correct, Your Honor. It says, to be completed by the voter. But then
if your argument would be that to be completed by voter would be over where the affidavit of provisional voter would be.
Correct. And everything on this form, there's nothing following the language to be completed by the voter. There's nothing there for the voter to actually fill out. In fact, everything on this page is for the election worker to fill out. And then there are seven arrows pointing the voter.
That's all above the statement about for the voter to be completed by the voter. Everything that the election judge does is above that statement.
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. But following the heading to be completed by voter, there is actually nothing for the voter to fill out there. There's dense small text printed that is in two languages, and then all of these seven arrows pointing the voter to the right, to a portion, the right-hand side, which has a header in large text saying affidavit of provisional voter, and then followed by a number of spaces for the voter to fill out their information, followed by a signature of the voter at the end of that right-hand side of the affidavit. There is nothing connecting that signature to anything that anything on the left-hand side.
Other than the seven arrows pointing from the instructions over to the affidavit.
after an instruction to complete, for the voter to complete information that is only on the right-hand side of the affidavit. Once again, there's nothing on the left-hand side for the voter to complete. So the instruction to be completed by voter is actually drawing the voter's eye to the right-hand side, where there that is the only place that the voter has anything to fill out.
What about the testimony about what she told the Star-Telegram, that she may have skimmed the affidavit?
Your Honor, that testimony is the same as the other testimony in this case that does not specify that she, in fact, did anything with the left-hand side of the affidavit. It is perfectly consistent with the fact that she read, filled out carefully and completely, and signed the right-hand side of the affidavit. Everyone agrees with that, and that is also consistent with what she told the Star-Telegram.
Just out of curiosity, let's assume for the moment, okay, that she did in fact read the language, the admonishment for language, okay, which says, I have not been finally convicted of a felony. The reader of that language, who would the I be? It would be the voter, potential voter, or provisional voter, would it not?
I believe that.
So if in fact she read that and it said, I have not been finally convicted of a felony, we know based upon her testimony and from the record that that would be an incorrect statement. Would that not be correct?
Based on this court's decision in 2020 that she, that being on federally supervised release falls under the scope of the illegal voting statute,
okay,
that is correct.
Let's take that a little bit further, okay? Somehow that we're into qualified immunity language, but somehow you've got to know that there's an actual something that violates somebody's civil rights. You cited that to us, et cetera, okay? Now you're saying that there actually has to be a case, a decision from a court, decisional authority, that says federal supervision is something that disqualifies you from this. And that's your argument, correct?
That is one of our arguments, Your Honor. That's
okay,
correct.
Okay, but that's the one you're referencing right now.
That is correct.
Okay. So you're saying that basically the very next language in here, which is, if a felon, I have completed all of my punishment. If a felon, I have completed all of my punishment, including any term of incarceration, which we knew she had at that point in time, parole, she wasn't subject to parole at that point in time, actually she might have been, supervision, period of probation, and then, or I have been pardoned. So basically, if she knows the I refers to her, she knows she's a felon, she knows that she hasn't completed her punishment, and she knows that her punishment included supervision. But your argument is that until a court actually interprets that language to say that supervision as referenced here means federal supervision, that she doesn't know that and nobody can know that. Is that correct?
I think there are two questions, but to your first question with respect to whether or not there was decisional law authority on this particular point, under the Court of Criminal Appeals decision and delay, we would say, yes, Your Honor, that unless and until a court, there's decisional law or other authority construing the election code as rendering an individual who is on supervised release ineligible to vote, that is correct. And for a couple of reasons, the first being that we're talking about here, again, a offense outside of the penal code. And so the principles animating the rule of lenity weigh in favor of having clarity around the scope of the illegal conduct here. In addition, we are talking about the election code, which implicates conduct that affects the ability to participate in the political process as well as related constitutional conduct. So in that case,
would you agree with me that the only two possible felonies would be state and federal? Would you agree with me with regard to that?
I agree with you.
There's not some otherworldly felony, okay? You understand the Fifth Circuit dealt with this issue in the early 80s in a civil rights action where Texans who had actually been convicted of federal felonies were arguing that the reenfranchisement language that the legislature had adopted wouldn't apply to them because the state didn't have the authority to reenfranchise them from a federal felony. The state only had the authority to reenfranchise state felons. But the Fifth Circuit, of course, the argument was made that this only applied to state felonies, and therefore you could be convicted of a federal felony and you wouldn't be disenfranchised whatsoever. So this has already been dealt with a long time ago in terms of felonies. So using the word felon in this language is already reasonably being interpreted to apply to both state and federal felonies. Were you aware of that?
Your Honor, that may be true, but once again, there is no reference here to federally supervised release. The argument here doesn't depend
but
on
what is your
felon.
Authority that it has to, in fact, say a federal felony? It actually has to have language in here that federal felonies disqualify you.
There are two reasons, Your Honor. First, I would refer you back to the Court of Criminal Appeals decision in DeLay, which has made the statement that unless and until there's decisional law or authority construing the election code to render the conduct in question illegal under the election code, that an individual can't actually have known that their conduct was illegal. But there is another reason why in this particular case that is not a reasonable conclusion, that an individual who has seen this language in this provisional ballot affidavit would then know that they were ineligible to vote. And that is because the amended statute as construed by the Court of Criminal Appeals says that you cannot presume knowledge based on the provisional ballot alone. And that necessarily includes everything, all the underlying steps, that it's not reasonable to infer the underlying steps that would be the basis for that presumption of knowledge. Otherwise, you would render that amendment essentially meaningless because you could simply get around that amendment by saying the signature then allows you to infer all these steps of knowledge, even though the amendment to the statute explicitly says you cannot presume knowledge, that the signature on the provisional ballot is insufficient to support a conviction.
Could I direct your attention back to the evidence that the state points to as being sufficient to show that Ms. Mason, in fact, read the left side? I mean, as I'm reading the actual testimony, it seems to be not absolute that, you know, yes, she was reading the left side, and I saw her trace her fingers down the left side. Is that so? Could you talk to what the actual trial evidence was?
Yes, absolutely. The trial evidence is that the only evidence with respect to the left-hand side specifically is that she looked it over for some number of seconds, and that is from Carl Dietrich's testimony. All the other testimony from Strybeck, the poll worker, is simply that she read it and read some portion. It's not explicit. It's not precise as to the left-hand side, which is the crucial aspect of the state's theory here. And even all of the cases that the state cites to support its theory that appearing to look at this page is sufficient to demonstrate and prove knowledge is to the contrary. It actually shows the deficiency of the state's proof here. In each of those cases, the relevant material was read aloud either to or in some cases also by the defendant. In addition, here again, we have Carl Dietrich's testimony on this point affirmatively saying that he could not be certain that she read that left-hand side.
Is that for the jury to decide a credibility question?
Not with respect to explicitly uncertain testimony, Your Honor. Here he's not saying that she read it and you could believe him or not. He's saying, I am not certain that she read it. And the cases cited in the briefs demonstrate that kind of explicitly uncertain testimony, you cannot make a reasonable inference to support the existence of that fact beyond a reasonable doubt without some other evidence that resolves that uncertainty. And here, none of that evidence resolves that uncertainty. It simply, again, supports the fact that she looked at something on this document. We all know that she looked at the right-hand side, filled it in, and completed it.
Thank you.
One quick question, and this goes back to your discussion about the reading aloud, okay? Do you interpret the amendment that the legislature did in the last legislative session to disallow consideration of the reading of this to the potential provisional voter? In other words, if Mr. Dietrich had in fact read this and said, do you understand this, and do you understand that in signing this you're representing that these things are true about you, and she went ahead and signed it, is that corroborating evidence that he read it to her, or because he read it to her and she signed it, is that all wrapped up in the signature of the provisional ballot, which the legislature now says can't be considered?
I think with respect to at least demonstrating that she heard the relevant language, that if election worker actually read that aloud to her, I think that would be a different case. That would certainly be corroborating evidence that she read it. Whether she actually realized from that she was ineligible to vote is still a separate question that must be proven outside the context of the provisional ballot. That's how the language of the amendment reads.
And how are we to determine that Judge Gonzalez, who clearly wasn't aware that the legislature was going to disallow this evidence as being the basis for his decision, how are we to reverse him on the basis of something that the legislature came up with after the fact?
Your Honor, I think that actually points to a bigger issue in this case with respect to Judge Gonzalez's ruling, which is based on evidence in the record from the findings of facts and conclusions of law. It's clear that even Judge Gonzalez didn't apply the actual correct standard for illegal voting as construed by the Court of Criminal Appeals.
Thank you. Your time's up.
May it please the court, counsel. This case was remanded for this court to determine if the record had any evidence to corroborate that appellant knew that she was ineligible to vote. Corroborative evidence is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Corroborative evidence is simply any evidence, direct or circumstantial, that would support a reasonable inference that something occurred. It is a very low bar to clear. The evidence in the record shows that appellant was sent notice that she was dropped from the voter rolls.
Was there any evidence that she herself received that?
No, but that isn't required. What is required is evidence that supports an inference. And that she was sent does support the inference. Now, it's not proof positive, and we're not claiming that it is, but it does support the inference. We're just looking for corroboration, something to corroborate the signature. And I want to correct what seems to be a misimpression here. The signature is allowed to be considered as evidence. It was not disqualified. The Court of Criminal Appeals just said something has to corroborate, something has to go along with the signature.
Well, it's the signature that is the attestation. It's the signature that under federal law is the written affirmation. So how is that not the affidavit? It can't be an affidavit unless you actually sign it. And the Court of Criminal Appeals has told us, based upon what the legislature has done, that it cannot be the sole basis. And that would have to include the signature, because otherwise it's not an affidavit.
Yes,
it's just a piece of paper.
I apologize. What they said was the signature standing alone cannot prove knowledge. It doesn't say that the signature cannot be evidence of knowledge.
It can be evidence of knowledge.
Yes.
But it has to be corroborated.
But it has to be corroborated.
Right.
That's correct.
So
that's
there's got to be something more than simply the affidavit, and the fact that she signed it is not outside the context of the affidavit. It is the affidavit.
Yes.
Let's assume for a moment that reading the left side of the form is not to give her an actual realization that she was ineligible to vote.
Okay.
Is there anything else that supports your case?
Well, yes. She testified on the stand. She read the affidavit and she said, that makes perfectly clear that I'm ineligible. And then what she said after that, which the fact finder could take any piece of it and believe, she said, if I would have read that, I would not have voted. Now, I'm paraphrasing.
their point, especially the amicus's point, is that after the fact doesn't prove anything.
Well, but what the fact finder could determine from that was that there was no difference in her ability to understand the language of the affidavit at trial and on November 8th, 2016. She's saying, if I had read this, this is perfectly clear. If I would have read this, which the fact finder did not have to believe, I wouldn't have voted, which means I would have understood it to mean that I'm ineligible.
Why doesn't the Lay's principle that unless there's clear decisional law on the topic, that it doesn't impart actual realization? That's what they criticize your brief for not discussing. That the word supervision does not cover supervised release under federal law.
Well, but at trial, the term was being used interchangeably, and appellant agreed with the state when they asked, well, would you agree that you were under supervised release supervision? And she also agreed that she read the supervision paperwork, and that supervision paperwork refers to the terms of supervision, not the terms of federal supervised release. Now this is her own testimony.
So does the rule of lenity come into play at all?
I don't know that it does, just from the fact that we do have evidence that she read it. We have evidence that could lead to the inference that she read it. We do have evidence that she understood it. And we do have evidence that by many witnesses that federal supervised release and supervision mean the same thing. And supervision is a much broader term than federal supervised release, and we would argue that it includes federal supervised release.
But their point is that determination had never been made till our first opinion.
Well, there's got to be a first time for everything, I guess, and I
agree with you, but it appears the delay says until that first time has occurred, the reasonable certainty test isn't met.
But if you do that, then there can't be a first time, because there's never going to be anything to refer back to under the delay rule.
If that's the delay rule. If that's the delay rule, because basically if for purposes of knowing you have to have a court tell you what the law is beforehand, then nobody's ever going to be convicted of that particular law.
That's correct.
I actually have a couple of questions. Where in this language, assuming your entire argument and forgetting about the amendment from the legislature and assuming that she in fact read every bit of this and understood it, where in this language does it actually say that if she's a felon, she's disqualified from voting? I'll help you. It's not in there.
Okay. I brought my readers.
No, it's not in there. It never actually says that. There's an inference of it, but it never actually says that, because it says it simply jumps from, you know, if a felon I have completed all of my punishment, or if I've been finally convicted of a felony, it jumps from there to I understand that giving false information under oath is a misdemeanor, which refers to what information she's actually giving, apparently, which would be the next page over, and I understand that it is a felony of the second degree to vote in an election for which I know I am not eligible. But there's nothing in this language that actually tells her she's not eligible. So there's a little bit of a defect in the Secretary of State here. Would you not agree? So how can it be evidence that she knew she was ineligible if the very thing that you're hanging your hat on the most doesn't actually tell her that?
It's the only piece of evidence that we're relying on.
I understand, but this is the most important piece, and arguably this is what Judge Gonzalez was relying on most, and it doesn't actually say that anywhere. So if a regular voter comes in and reads that, okay, she reads it, says, I'm a felon. Okay, I haven't completed my sentence. I haven't completed my punishment. And, yeah, supervision was part of my punishment. But there is nothing in this that tells her what the consequences, that that renders her ineligible in any way, shape, or form.
That may be true, but she testified that that language made it perfectly clear to her that she was ineligible to vote and that she would not have voted had she read it. This is in the record. This was her testimony.
Okay, there's one other thing in here, and that is, and this is something that's been hanging out here the whole time, I mentioned it in a footnote in the original opinion, and that is Secretary of State apparently hasn't read the Constitution, because the Constitution says if you've been convicted of forgery, bribery, or perjury, or other high crime, that it disqualifies you forever, absent a pardon from the government, because there's no language in the Texas Constitution that says the legislature can re-enfranchise you. And we cited in our opinion in Ray Birdwell, the Supreme Court held that committing a fraud against the United States constitutes a crime of moral turpitude that would fall within the high crime understanding. Yet there's nothing in here from the Secretary of State that accurately states the law with regard to that. That would have been information she might want to have known it too. Would you not agree?
Possibly, but if I could get back to why we're here. Because why we're here is to determine whether there was corroboration of her knowledge.
But you're arguing that information is creates a reasonable inference that she knew she was ineligible when the language itself doesn't say she was ineligible.
The language itself doesn't, but her testimony does. She said she understood that language to mean that she was ineligible. This was her testimony. She said, I understand that says that I am not eligible to vote, and I wouldn't have voted had I read it. That right there is her saying her knowledge of it, regardless of what might be missing from the affidavit. And the issue isn't whether the affidavit has all of the correct language. The issue is, did she know?
What's the purpose of the affidavit requirement? Isn't the purpose of the affidavit requirement it has to be an attestation that I am, in fact, an eligible voter?
Yes.
And the vast majority of people that walk into a voting station have no idea what the actual elements are. And so the Secretary of State, even though the statute doesn't actually require the Secretary of State to put the elements of qualifications in there, that's what this is. But he or she's done it in a negative context. Okay? And so that's what that is. That's what you're attesting to. But because it's on a different page from where the signature is, seems to be a little bit disconcerting.
Again, possibly. But what we're talking about is whether she had knowledge, and she testified that language informed her sufficiently that she was ineligible to vote. She said this. She read it on the stand, and she said, that makes perfectly clear that I was ineligible. Had I read it, I wouldn't have voted. So then that makes the issue whether she read it or not, because she said she understood that language to mean exactly what the state says that she understood.
Okay.
Are there any other questions regarding the sufficiency of corroboration? Or regarding any corroboration?
What's your position with regard to whether or not, well, I think you've already answered the question in retrospect. So, no, I don't have any further questions.
Are there any questions regarding the ineffective assistance claims?
No.
And then with the court's permission, I will take my seat.
We're going to have to address sufficiency to get to the ineffective assistance claim, aren't we?
I don't understand your question.
Isn't she titled to an acquittal under the legal sufficiency?
I'm sorry?
Sufficiency argument.
In other words, we would have to find the evidence sufficient to even get to.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't understand the question, Your Honor.
I have the same problems with him.
Okay. If there are no other questions, then with the court's permission, I will take my seat.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal. Mm-hmm.
A couple of points. First of all, with respect to what Ms. Mason might have understood from reading the left-hand side of the ballot, we just emphasize that the Court of Criminal Appeals has construed the illegal voting statute to require that she not a proof that she actually realized, not that a reasonable person could or that she should have realized.
And so reasonable inference has been done away with, and that's the interpretation of the Court of Criminal Appeals, that the new amendment says reasonable inference is not something that we can use in a Jackson sufficiency evaluation?
Not with respect to the language of the provisional ballot itself, which is constrained in terms of the type of proof that it can provide outside of additional corroboration of knowledge. And speaking of additional corroboration of knowledge, talking about Ms. Mason's testimony, opposing counsel mischaracterizes the extent of that testimony. Ms. Mason's, in none of her statements did she say that if she had read that language, she would have known she was ineligible to vote. The testimony amounts to a statement that had I known I was ineligible to vote, I would not have voted. I would have walked away. I would not have risked my time with my family.
The language actually indicates that she understood it was not ambiguous to her what the statement was making.
The statement, there was one statement where trial counsel, the prosecution, asked whether or not she understood the language rendered her ineligible to vote, and she said correct, but there is no time, there's nothing connecting her statement in 2018 after she's been prosecuted for 2 years for being told that she was not eligible to vote being on federal supervised release. There's nothing connecting that language to what she actually knew in 2016. In fact, earlier that time difference here is reflected in an earlier testimony where the prosecution asks her, do you understand that this language, the statements on the left-hand side of the ballot affidavit, lay out what the requirements for being eligible to vote are? And she says, I understand it now. And that reflects what is happening here. And you cannot dissociate her testimony from that, from her prior later testimony, from this earlier statement that she's talking about what she understands what she understands today. And that makes perfect sense under the circumstance. I point also to the remarks of one of the sponsors of the amendment to the statute, remarks that the Court of Criminal Appeals relied on as persuasive authority, that he himself would not have known that being on federally supervised release would render you ineligible. So that the fact of the matter is, it is not necessarily a clear statement.
So 20 years worth of decisional authority out of both this state and this Court of the Fifth Circuit concerning that applied to federal felonies, we're to ignore that.
Well, no, Your Honor, we're talking.
The language, the word supervision is actually in the statute. So somehow we're just to determine that we can't, there's some court before that actually becomes a crime that can be committed, some court somewhere has to interpret what the word supervision means. That's your position.
Your Honor, the point that I'm making is simply from reading the left-hand side of the statute would not necessarily have been clear to someone reading this language that we're talking about eligibility requirements, as you've pointed out. And in fact, it says in the left-hand side, I understand that giving false information under oath is a misdemeanor, not talking about eligibility to vote, talking about something else entirely. And so I don't think it's necessarily clear that she would have actually realized in that moment from looking at this language, and therefore it wouldn't have been a rational inference.
I don't know where I've seen this. I want to say it may be in a federal CFR, but a federal ballot actually has a box with the admonishment in it, with the signature line in it, and you are, in fact, signing to what's in the box, okay? So if the Secretary of State, for example, came up with that and put that on a provisional ballot, could that be used then as evidence that they knew, in fact, that they were ineligible but went ahead and voted?
Under the amended statute, I don't know if that would be true. However, potentially a different offense of perjury or some other type of thing. And I note here on this provisional ballot on the right-hand side, there is a statement that says, are you a U.S. citizen? And so there is some differentiation in terms of some eligibility requirements here. I would end by saying that if the court agrees that the evidence is sufficient to support a finding that Ms. Mason actually realized she was ineligible, then the court must acquit. But if it doesn't, then given the evidence in the record that makes clear that the trial court did not apply the correct standard for illegal voting offense as construed by the Court of Criminal Appeals, this court should at minimum remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We very much appreciate the oral argument. It's been quite helpful. And your case is submitted. And with that, we stand adjourned. Thank you.